like this, it always feels a little more informal, more relaxed. We can visit, we can talk, and usually a smaller number, and that's a good thing in some ways too, because I get to know more of you more intimately that way. And so I look forward to these morning sessions with you. We are going to be studying the book of Daniel, and I see we're passing out sheets there if you don't have one. We're going to start out with kind of a introduction to the book, and I'd like for you to turn your Bibles to Psalm 89. Why was the book of Daniel written? Of course, we know a little bit of the context of the book of Daniel. We know that it is the first three kings of what we call the United Kingdom, Saul, David, and Solomon, ended with a division in 931 into the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah, Israel being taken off into captivity by Assyria in 722, and then Judah in a series of deportations beginning in 605, 597, and then 586, the temple in Jerusalem being destroyed. Daniel and his friends taken off in this first one in 605. But there was a promise that was made to David. Remember when he was planning to build a temple, and God said, you're not going to build a house for my name. I'm going to build you a house. And I'm going to establish your son. Your son's going to build me a house. And he said, your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. And this promise was tested several times, if you remember. There was even one occasion where the descendant of David was down to one. Athaliah going on a rampage, killing all of her grandchildren, and yet Jehoshaphat saved the day and saved that. And it was because of this promise. God said, you're going to have a son to sit on the throne. Well, what were the people thinking when finally Jerusalem fell? There are a lot of people who said that would never happen. And you could imagine the false teachers who were saying peace and safety and will continue. They would refer back to this promise. God made a promise. He's not going to go back on that. Well, what are the people thinking as they're going off into captivity and they realize there is no man sitting on the throne? There is no throne to be sat upon. I want you to read with me a few verses from Psalm 89. Psalm 89 is a song of praise to God for His faithfulness. The fact that He keeps His promises. And specifically, the promise that was made to David. Psalm 89 verse 1, I will sing of the steadfast love of the Lord forever with my mouth. I will make known your faithfulness to all generations. For I said, steadfast love will be built up forever. In the heavens you will establish your faithfulness. You have said, I've made a covenant with my chosen one. I've sworn to David, my servant. I will establish your offspring forever and build your throne for all generations. And he goes on for the next several verses praising God for his faithfulness. He comes back to David in verse 19. Of old you spoke in a vision to your godly one and said, I have granted help to one who is mighty. I have exalted one chosen from the people. I have found David, my servant, with my holy oil. I have anointed him, so that my hand shall be established with him. My arm also shall strengthen him. The enemy shall not outwit him. The wicked shall not humble him. I will crush his foes before him and strike down those who hate him. My faithfulness and my steadfast love shall be with him. And in my name shall his horn be exalted. I will set his hand on the sea and his right hand on the rivers. He shall cry to me, you are my father. Remember, that's what God said. He shall be a son to me. I shall be his father. He shall cry to me, you are my father, my God, and the rock of my salvation. And I will make him the firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth. My steadfast love I will keep for him forever, and my covenant will stand firm for him. I will establish his offspring forever and his throne as the days of the heavens. If his children forsake my law and do not walk according to my rules, if they violate my statutes and do not keep my commandments, then I will punish their transgression with a rod and their iniquity was Christ. Remember, God said something about that in dealing with his son. But, verse 33, I will not remove from him my steadfast love or be false to my faithfulness. I will not violate my covenant or alter the word that went forth from my lips. Once for all, I have sworn by my holiness, I will not lie to David. His offspring shall endure forever. His throne as long as the sun before me, like the moon, it shall be established forever, a faithful witness in the skies. And if that's how the psalm ended, we would all say, amen. That's not how the psalm ends. But now, you have cast off and rejected. You are full of wrath against your anointed. You have renounced the covenant with your servant. You have defiled his crown in the dust. You have breached all his walls. You have laid his strongholds in ruins. All who pass by plunder him. He has become the scorn of his neighbors. You have exalted the right hand of his foes, and you have made all his enemies rejoice. You can imagine the taunts and the rejoicing as they were brought into Babylon. You have also turned back the edge of his sword. You have not made him stand in battle. You have made his splendor to cease and cast his throne to the ground. You have cut short the days of his youth. You have covered him with shame. And here comes the lament. This is the typical psalm of lamentation where the faithful cry out to God, how long, O Lord, will you hide yourself forever? How long will your wrath burn like fire? Remember how short my time is, for what vanity you have created all the children of man. And he goes on, lamenting the fact that from all appearances, it seems like God has gone back on his promise. Now, I don't believe for a minute that the psalmist really believes that God is going to be false to his faithfulness, because he spent so many verses praising God's faithfulness. But you hear the tension in this psalm. There's a cognitive dissonance right now in the heart of the psalmist and in the heart of the people who trust in God and believe in God. What's going on? This is not what was supposed to happen. We understand that you said if David's son would be rebellious against you, that you would punish him and strike him, but to remove him from the throne? What's going on? Well, I think it's to these questions that the book of Daniel is directed. I think that Daniel is seeking to answer the 586 questions, which is, what has happened to God's promise? Is God not able? Is it true that the gods of Babylon are just greater than our God? Or has God forgotten us and been unfaithful to his promise? The book of Daniel was written in two languages. Chapter 1 and chapters 8 to the end were written in Hebrew, which is the language of Israel. But chapters 2 through 7, the most iconic chapters of Daniel, were written in Aramaic, which was the language of the empire. That's the language that Daniel and his friends would have learned when they came into Babylon. And it was the language of the conquered world at that time. Same way Greek would have been the language throughout the known world during the New Testament age. And so Aramaic is what these six chapters were written in. And these six chapters basically have three themes. The first theme, found in chapters 2 and 7, is that there's going to be four world empires to rise and fall before God fulfills the promise that he made to David. And so God is going to keep his promise, but it's going to happen in his time. It's not going to be when they come back. Zerubbabel is in the line of David, but he was not the fulfillment. He was not a king. At best, he was a weak governor. It's going to be after the Babylonian Empire falls, the Medes and the Persians will reign, and Daniel will be a part of that. And then the Greeks will come with Alexander the Great, and then finally the Romans. And of course, chapters 8 through 12 give us a lot more details about all the intricate things are going to happen in history. But this is the rough outline. In chapters 2 and chapters 7, in both of the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, and then the vision that Daniel had in chapter 7, we're given a broad outline of exactly when God is going to bring His Son, His Anointed One, His Christ, to come and reign and rule over the whole earth. Chapters 3 and 6 answers the question of, has God forgotten His people? Has He abandoned us to Babylon? And the answer is no. To those who are faithful, to those who have not turned their back on God, have remembered who they are, and are continuing to obey God's commandments and keep the covenant, God not only rescues them in chapters 3 and 6, but He also exalts them. And we see that in the fiery furnace with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and then Daniel, who prays, even though he's told it's illegal to pray, willing to be thrown into the den of lions. Daniel is also protected and exalted. And then the heart of all of this is chapters 4 and 5, which answers the question of, is God really in control? And the answer is a resounding yes. God makes that abundantly clear. First of all, with proud Nebuchadnezzar, who is made to eat grass, and then with prideful Belshazzar, who dies the same night that he sees the handwriting on the wall, and the empire falls that very night. God is in control. That's the message of Daniel. The book of Daniel is not really about Daniel, although inspiring stories about him and his friends, so much that we can and should learn. But really, the book of Daniel is about God. It's about God's sovereignty. It's about God's faithfulness. It's about God's redemptive purpose, what God's plan is, and how He's going to bring about His promises to us. And it is a very relevant message for us today. And so this is just kind of an introduction. We'll come back to this more throughout the series, but wanted to do that before we got into chapter 1. So go ahead and turn over to Daniel chapter 1, and we'll talk about how we need to preserve our identity living in Babylon. So how does the book of Daniel begin? Well, it begins with these four young men who were taken away from their home and are presented with various challenges from the time that they arrived. They have to decide who they are. And I've come to the conclusion that our identity is one of the most important things about us, the way we see ourselves. You know, when I was in school, you could pretty much decide what group someone was in just by looking at them, how they dressed. You had different groups and cliques and whatever in school, and you had the jocks and you had the nerds and you had the goths and you had the skaters and rockers, and everybody had their own group. And you could see it in the way that they dressed. You could tell by the music that they listened to. You could tell by the associations that they had, even the kind of parties that they went to, right? The games that they played. And the thing about a group mentality is there is a conformity to the identity of the group. I saw that in Atlanta. In Atlanta, especially in the Clarkston area on the east side of Atlanta, just south of Stone Mountain, if you've been to Stone Mountain before, a high concentration of immigrants from around the world, many of those who were forcibly taken from their homes. I told you yesterday about the lady and her son from Ethiopia. Or she was from Ethiopia. She left in the 70s. There was a civil war going on in Ethiopia. Her brother was killed in the civil war. She was forced from her home. She went to different countries in Africa before she ended up in New York and then finally settled in Clarkston. And she took me to their church, Ethiopian Orthodox Church. She said it would look exactly like a Ethiopian church looked like if you went to Ethiopia. Same artwork. In fact, the large murals up at the front of the church building were made by an Ethiopian and shipped overseas. Looked exactly the same. She took me to their restaurants, to their grocery stores. I mean, you felt like you were in Ethiopia, you know, when you went in this little community. A very tight-knit community with a very firm sense of identity. They ate the same food. They spoke their language. They could tell. You know, it was interesting to me. She always knew when there was an Ethiopian in the room, and she would talk to them. She could tell who was an Ethiopian. And there were several other groups like that. I mean, you would feel like you were in India in certain apartment complexes or, you know, somewhere else. I mean, we saw those kind of groups. And you understand, that's exactly what happened when peoples were taken from their homes forcibly by Babylon, or when people were scattered during the Roman conquest. If you were to go to the city of Rome, you could identify the Jewish neighborhoods. And you would know this is where the Jews are. You would see their synagogues, you would see their grocery stores, you would see, you know, the Hebrew lettering on signs in various places. You would know I'm among Jewish people when I'm here. And that was very important, because what they were doing is they were preserving their identity. And there's something we can learn from Daniel chapter 1. Because we, like Daniel, are living in Babylon. This is not our home. We speak a different language. We wear different clothes. We eat and drink different things. We go to different parties. We are different. And we need to remember that. And so let's see what we can learn from Daniel chapter 1 that will help us living in Babylon today. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah he called Shadrach. Mishael he called Meshach. And Azariah he called Abednego. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king who assigned your food and your drink, for why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. And Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. As for these 4 youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them, and among all of them none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they stood before the king. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. So, a few things we want to look at. First of all, I want us to see from the chapter how Babylon tried to change Daniel. And of course, there's practical reasons why Babylon would want to change them. You want them to be submissive. They're serving the king. You don't want to do anything before the king that's going to be obnoxious or out of character or out of disrespect to the king. You want the king to feel very comfortable with those who are serving him. And you want them to be loyal. And the way you make someone loyal is you convert them. You want to make them good citizens, right? That's one of the things that we teach our kids in school. We teach them citizenship. We teach them the Pledge of Allegiance. We want our children to be loyal to their country, right? Well, they wanted these men to be loyal to Babylon. And so they were doing more than just teaching them the language. They were wanting to change them, to change their loyalties, to change their character, to change their habits and behaviors, to make them Babylonians. That was their purpose. That's how they would be most useful to the king. And so how did they do that? Well, the first thing is they came back with trophies. So we read about these trophies later in chapter 5 when Belshazzar decides he's going to throw this big feast, and he brings in the vessels that were taken from the house of God. Why didn't they just melt those down? Why would they want these vessels? I mean, the gold has intrinsic value. They could use that gold and make different kinds of vessels for their gods or make other gods, right? Why not just take the gold and use the gold? Why do they need these vessels? Well, it's because these vessels were symbolic, and these vessels said in a very clear way, we won. And not just we, but our gods won. Your God is less than our gods. That was the message. And so these vessels were a way of saying to Daniel and his friends, See, your God couldn't save you. You're now ours because our God, our gods are greater than yours. Another thing that we see is that they went through this education. And like I said, they had to learn the language. They had to learn Aramaic to be functional. They don't need to be having a translator with them all the time like me and Steve are going to need in Zimbabwe. They need to speak the language. But it's more than just the language. They learn the language and the literature. What's the purpose of the literature? Well, there may be some grammar and some things like that that would be useful and helpful, but you understand what literature is. Literature speaks of beliefs. Literature speaks of values. Literature communicates culture. They're wanting them to buy in. And the literature would include writings and stories about the gods themselves. Those are some of the greatest works of poetry and works of literature that come from the ancient times. And, of course, we're holding in our hands the Jewish literature, right? That's the purpose of these stories. It's not just that the Babylonians went and conquered someone. It's that their gods conquered someone. And they want these men to study those victories and study about why these gods are so great. And so there's an education that's involved in all of this. And then their names. And this would have been the most difficult thing, I think, for Daniel and his friends, to answer to these new names. Daniel was called Belteshazzar. Hananiah's name was changed to Shadrach. Mishael's name was changed to Meshach, and Azariah's name was changed to Abednego. Now, I don't think that they changed their names just because they had a hard time pronouncing Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, or Daniel. I think they changed their names intentionally because of what these names meant. Here's the Hebrew meaning of the name, and then the Babylonian name and what it means. The Lord is gracious, Hananiah meant. Shadrach means by the command of Aku, one of their gods. Mishael, who is what God is? Meshach, who is what Aku is? Very subtle change there. Azariah, the Lord has helped. Abednego, the servant of Nebo. And then Daniel, God is my judge. Belteshazzar, may Balak protect. Okay, so imagine this is you, right? Imagine if America were defeated by some Muslim country and our children were taken away. And my name is no longer David. My name is Muhammad. I will answer to Muhammad now. That's my name. And your name has changed too. And you're learning Arabic. Not allowed to speak English anymore. Don't speak to us in English. That's your old language. You're a new person now. Speak to us in Arabic. And you're going to study the Quran. And you're going to study all the writings that came out of that. And the literature. And you're going to be in this school for 3 years. And you're going to work hard. Or there will be consequences. How would you feel about that? How do you think Daniel and his friends felt about that? That would be hard. But you know what? Daniel and his friends thrived in this environment. They answered to their new names. They were very respectful of those who were over them. All appearances are they worked very hard at their studies. They were 10 times better than their companions, which meant that they did all the work that they were supposed to do and had very good grades in their new school education. Did you know there was a place where they drew the line and said, we can't do that? How did Daniel maintain his identity? Well, a few things. Number one, he saw the gold vessels that were taken out of the temple. But he knew why this had happened. The very first or the very second verse tells us the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. This phrase, the Lord gave, is repeated 3 times in chapter 1. The Lord gave Daniel and his friends favor. The Lord gave Daniel and his friends this wisdom and knowledge. God is behind all of this, and Daniel knew that. Even though all appearances were that they had been defeated, he knew the reason why they were taken off into captivity. This was the discipline of God. This was because the people had been unfaithful to God. They had been worshiping idols, and now God was punishing them. He had heard what Isaiah had said. He had heard what Jeremiah was preaching. He knew, I believe, from his parents, I believe that I could be wrong about this, but I think all appearances were, from his own parents, he had heard what the consequences of disobedience would be. They had read to him Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus chapter 26. He knew that this was all part of the curse and that they were being taken off because God was behind all of it. And Daniel never stopped praying. Daniel never forgot who he was or where he came from. Now we see him and his friends praying in chapter 2. Of course, chapter 6 is the most famous chapter of Daniel praying, where when it's illegal, and this is now in another empire, and now 70 years later, so he's probably 80-something, 90-something years old by this point, he's still praying. And as I said at some point this weekend, he has his windows open toward Jerusalem, right? And I believe he's praying toward Jerusalem because of the promise that God made to Solomon, that if my people pray toward this place, even though they may be off in captivity, that I will hear their prayer and I'll respond. And that's why Daniel's praying. That's the reason he prays in Daniel chapter 9, too. He believes that God will respond to their prayers. But you may ask Daniel, why are you praying toward Jerusalem? There is no temple at this point. Why are you still praying? It's because he believes that God is not limited to a temple made by hands. He believes God is still there. His presence is still there among them, even though they're hundreds of miles away from home. And his windows are open toward Jerusalem because he says, that's my home. This is not my home. And when you think of Daniel and his friends, don't think of them suffering in Babylon physically. The accommodations in Babylon were probably a lot better than what they had in Jerusalem. I mean, Daniel is living a good life, especially after he receives all of these promotions, right? I mean, he is being groomed to be second in command over all the empire by the time we come to chapter 6. And yet, he doesn't see himself as a Persian. He doesn't see himself as a Chaldean, as a Babylonian. He knows who he is, and he knows where he came from. And that's the hard thing for us. The reason why we are tempted to lose our identity is because we've got all this stuff. And we define ourselves by our clothes. And we define ourselves by our palaces that we live in. And we define ourselves by our jobs and our titles and the money we get. And we forget that all of that means nothing. It means nothing apart from God. Daniel never forgot who he was because he stayed anchored by things like prayer. I don't know if he had a Bible. I think probably not. But I would imagine that he and his friends had memorized a lot of Scripture. And they continued reciting the Scriptures, reminding themselves of the promises of God, reminding themselves of who they were. Daniel never forgot who he was. And what chapter 1 tells us is that though he was willing to answer to a new name, and though he was willing to learn the language and the literature of the Chaldeans, and though he was willing to be submissive to his new masters, there was a line that he would not cross. He would not defile himself with that food or that wine. We don't know why. It could be that the food and wine was used in the worship of idols. It could be because the meat was unclean and therefore forbidden. But for whatever reason, he said, this is who I am, and I'm not going to eat that meat, and I'm not going to drink that wine. Is that identity so entrenched in us that we feel the same way? Or do we see very little difference between us and the Gentiles around us? That's the question. So how can we maintain our identity? Look over at 1 Peter. I think that 1 Peter is inspired largely by the book of Daniel. I think I mentioned this at some point this weekend, but yesterday we talked about 1 Peter. And it opens in the first couple of verses with Peter describing them as elect exiles. They don't belong here. They live in a different world. He addresses them in chapter 5 from Babylon. I don't know if he's literally in Babylon or if he's in Rome using Babylon as a name. But either way, the point is the same. In chapter 5, he talks about the devil, who is a roaring lion. Think about Daniel 6. In chapter 1 and chapter 4, he talks about the fiery trials that they're undergoing. Think about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In chapter 2 and verse 11, he says, beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, think about Daniel in chapter 6, when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. The most glorious praise in the book of Daniel comes not from the Hebrews. It comes from the Gentiles. Amazing confessions about the greatness of God. And all because of these young men and old men in chapter 6 who knew who they were. And God's name was praised because of that. And so he opens, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who are elect exiles of the dispersion. We need to see ourselves as strangers in this world. He says in chapter 1 and verse 13, therefore, preparing your minds for action, girding up the loins of your mind is the way that should be translated, and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. In other words, don't get captivated by all the stuff in this world, the gold, the silver, all those perishable things. Don't focus on those things. Set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance, But as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct, since it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy. And if you call on him as Father, who judges impartially according to each one's deeds, conduct yourselves with fear throughout the time of your exile. Remember who you are. That's what he's saying. Conduct yourselves as children of the King of kings, the God of gods, the Lord of lords. Remember that he is reigning and ruling in heaven, that we submit to the emperor. He says that in chapter 2. But ultimately, our submission to him is because we fear God. Same verse in chapter 2 and verse 17. We do this out of respect for God. The reason why Daniel and his friends were so submissive to the king was because they respected God. They said, that's what we do to those who are in authority because we have a conscience toward God. But when that king tells us to do something that violates what God has told us to do, we remember who we are and we do not eat that food and we do not drink that wine. We don't bow down to their images and we don't pray their prayers. That's what Daniel and his friends did. And they are elect. They are chosen by God. In chapter 2 and verse 4, as you come to him, a living stone rejected by men. The world has nothing for us. The world doesn't want us. A living stone rejected by men, but in the sight of God, chosen and precious. That's what he's saying. He's saying, yes, you're exiles. Yes, you don't belong here, but remember, you do belong somewhere else because you've been chosen. You've been elected by God. And he refers to our God as our Father. We have not been forgotten. He's right there with us. He's right there with us in the fiery furnace. He's with us in the den of lions. We're not by ourselves. Our Father will never leave us. He'll never forsake us. And so we need to entrust our souls to a faithful Creator while doing good. That's the message of 1 Peter. And so, the lesson is, when you know who you are, you can be different in what you wear, in what you drink, and your sexual purity. Look over at chapter 3. This is in the section of submission where he says to citizens to be submissive to their governors and kings and the emperor. He says to servants to be submissive to their masters. And then finally, after talking about the submission of Christ, he says to wives to be submissive to their husbands. And he says to the wives in verse 3, do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair and the putting on of gold jewelry or the clothing you wear, but let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit. Let me stop right there. When he says imperishable, there's been two other times in chapter 1 that he's spoken of perishable things like silver or gold. Silver and gold perish, chapter 1 says twice. But there are some imperishable things that we have that make up our inheritance. And so he says to the women, don't be so concerned about the gold and the silver you wear because you know those things are perishable. But think about that part of you that will never be diminished, that will never fade away, that is eternal, the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, and here's the important part, which in God's sight is very precious. He used that word precious when speaking of the blood of Christ. He says you are not redeemed with perishable things like silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ. And here he says this imperishable beauty that God sees is very precious. Not just precious, but very precious. And so my question to the young ladies, but ladies of any age and men as well for that matter, is who are you dressing for? Who are you trying to impress? I know the pressure. I feel it every time I go with my daughters. And they're always concerned about the examinations. I know the pressure. You don't want to look different. You don't want to stick out. But you understand we have to. We have to look different. Because we're not trying to impress the world. We're trying to impress God. And His view of us is all that matters. I hope that my view of my daughters matters to them. But I hope more than that, they're concerned about how God sees them and the way that they dress. And here we can say the same thing about drinking and sexual purity. He goes on and talks about that in chapter 4. He says, "Since therefore Christ suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same way of thinking. Be prepared to suffer. For whoever has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live for the rest of his time in the flesh." And we're just exiles here. "The rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for human passions, but for the will of God. For the time that is past suffices for doing what the Gentiles want to do, living in sensuality, passions, drunkenness, orgies, drinking parties, lawless idolatry." And you know, that's all associated with idolatry. The idol temples in the first century were glorified brothels. That's what they were. And it would have resembled very much, and I find the architecture at the University of Alabama at all the frat houses very ironic, because we've taken on the imagery and the substance of what happened in those temples. And so these idol temples were just glorified frat parties, right? And again, there's a lot of pressure, because if you don't drink and you don't go along with the crowd and do what they're doing, guess what? You don't belong. You're not in the club. You're not in the clique. You're not a part of that group. You've lost your identity with that group. You've lost their approval. Peter says you don't need their approval. You don't want their approval. They're the Gentiles. God's going to judge them. You know that. You know God doesn't approve of them. You're not living for their approval anymore. You're living for the will of God. You spent enough time in your life living for their approval. And there are going to be times in your life where you may be pressured, young ladies or young men, into doing something that you're very uncomfortable with doing and you don't believe is right, and yet he or she is telling you, if you really loved me, you would do this. Listen, you don't need their love. Not that that is love. That's selfishness. That's what that is. No one who truly loves you would ever press you to do anything that you felt uncomfortable with doing. But you don't need them. And you say, well, how am I ever going to get married? Right? If you're a child of God, you are married. You're married to Christ. And that man should have to fight through Jesus to get your heart. And vice versa if you're a guy. You're already married. You don't need a man. You don't need a woman. You don't need that kind of man or that kind of woman. For sure. You feel secure in the fact that you are loved, that you are chosen by God. And let that be your identity. Let that be who you are. And don't let anybody sway you from that. And so that's the challenge of living in Babylon. We are going to stick out like a sore thumb. And things are only going to get worse. As bad as they seem right now. We were talking last night, or a couple of nights ago, I think, about how rapidly things have changed. So dramatically different. I mean, I'm not that old. I'm not an old preacher, but I feel like an old preacher when I think about how different things were when I began preaching. The lessons I preached back then versus now. And so it's going to be a challenge. It's going to be hard. And I feel for my kids. And I feel for young people. But we need to be willing to go through the fire. We need to be willing to walk into the lion's den. Because God matters more to us than anything else. And we'd be willing to sacrifice anything to know that He's pleased with us. And so that's a big task. That's a big call, right? And if you're not a Christian right now, you may be thinking, well, why would I ever sign up for that? To be a part of this weird people that dress funny and they don't have any fun. We do have a lot of fun, by the way. Just not worldly fun. Why would I ever want to do that? Well, it's because of what Peter tells us. That we're not redeemed with perishable things like silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot. How much are you worth to God? He's already shown you. He gave His Son to die for you. That's how much He's worth for you. You want to be married to someone? Marry someone who would give up the most precious thing to you to win your love. That's who you want to marry. That's when you know true love. And you have found true love when you understand that that's exactly what God has done for you. And so if you have been drawn to that and you realize that that's what God has done for you, if you believe that Jesus has died for you and He's risen again, reigning in heaven, Lord of lords, King of kings, waiting to come again to receive His own, and you'll be taken up with Him as you respond right now. If you're ready to respond to that invitation, why don't you come as we stand and sing.